Social commentary, along with expert discussion of the important issues and events of today and yesteryear. So keep it locked into WBAI in New York, 99.5 FM.
The Midnight Ravers, where every show is a special.
Hi, this is Tom Hartman, host of the Tom Hartman Program. Join me every weekday afternoon at 2 p.m. for feisty debates, my take on the news and issues of the day, and some of the smartest callers in radio. That's the Tom Hartman Program every weekday afternoon at 2, right here on WBAI, Free Speech Radio, 99.5 FM, Pacifica Radio, New York. Tag, you're it.
Yo, this is G-Love on WBAI, New York, New York.
This is Phil Donahue. I have 600 channels in my home, but 400 of them are selling the Bowflex machine. That's why I listen to WBAI New York.
The WBAI Local Station Board Town Hall Planning Group is meeting on August 21st at 7 p.m., and you're invited. It is at the Wall Street Atrium, 60 Wall Street in Manhattan. You are invited to participate and share your ideas. That's 7 p.m., August 21st, at the Wall Street Atrium, 60 Wall Street in Manhattan. See you there.
Thanks to you.
Thank you for thinking of me.
And I thank you.
And I thank you.
Let's say thank you to all you people out there.
I want to thank each and every one of you for coming by.
And while he's thanking those folks, let me take this opportunity to thank all of you, our listeners and support staff, our contributors, our interns, the volunteers, producers, and the entire crew that works countless hours to bring WBAI into your lives.
Thank you, people. Thank you.
Thanks to you.
Thank you for thinking of me.
And I thank you.
And I thank you.
Let us say thank you to all you people out there.
I want to thank each and every one of you.
And while he's thanking those folks, let me take this opportunity to thank all of you, our listeners and support staff, our contributors, our interns, the volunteers, producers, and the entire crew that works countless hours to bring WBAI into your lives.
The 2019 local station board elections are underway. Visit elections.pacifica.org for candidates' written statements, video cards, and debates. As of August 15th, your ballot will come in one of three forms: an email ballot, a brightly colored postcard, or, if you requested it, a paper ballot from Honest Ballot. If you cannot find your ballot, please fill out a ballot request form on elections.pacifica.org. Members in need of a paper ballot can leave a voicemail at 510-854-9663. Paper ballot replacements will be issued through October 7th. All ballots must be received by October 15th, 11:59 p.m. Eastern Standard Time to be counted. It's 99.5 FM WBAI in New York and online at WBAI.org.
Failure is impossible. Victory's inside. Failure is impossible. We will have equal rights.
August 26th will mark the 99th anniversary of women finally winning the right to vote after a struggle of 72 years. On Monday, August 26th, from 8 to 10 p.m., join the Joy of Resistance for a special on this rich history. We will speak with Sally Roche Wagner on her acclaimed new book, The Woman's Suffrage Movement. We'll present a play with period music, where you'll hear the actual words of Frederick Douglass, Sojourner Truth, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, and others, as after the Civil War, they debated whether to push for black men or white women getting the vote, or to hold out for everyone getting it. So tune in on Monday, August 26th, 8 to 10 p.m., for a new look at the fight for women's suffrage. and what we can learn from it today.
Hey, everybody, this is Kev O'Donoghue of The Positive Mind asking you to please donate to WBAI. You can do it as simply as clicking on WBAI.org and becoming a WBAI buddy. For $10 a month, we will take out of your credit card your donation of $10 a month, $120 for the full year to become one of our buddies. We need your buddy, a buddy. Don't we all, as we say in The Positive Mind? We all need people. That's right. We all need people. And so WBAI needs you to become a buddy to stay connected with us. It's as simple as a computer click. It is greatly appreciated. Please do it in the name of The Positive Mind. And we will keep bringing you ideas, concepts, and guests. Try and help you lead a more positively minded life.
Don't forget, y'all, our allies are our allies. And our enemies are our enemies. We can never unite with our enemies against our allies. Never.
Newark Mayor Roz Baraka at the Newark Town Hall on gentrification in Black America.
And you can't ever, ever, ever leave your allies out there by themselves because you have a problem with them and join your enemies. And I'm not saying struggle with them. Fight with them like cats and dogs. But when the fight is over, you love them to life. And when it's finished, you say, this is the law. When y'all come out the room, when people ask you what happened, I don't know what happened in there, but I know what's happening out here. We have to have that operational unity. We have to have operational unity like that. Anybody that's opposed is COINTELPRO.
This is listener-sponsored WBAI New York.
All right, coming up next, Code Pink Radio. Rose Asaf here in studio.
Bush and Bin Laden, you think they're foes? They're in business together. Daddy Bush knows the Carlyle Group since years before been raking in billions and itching for more.
It's blood for oil. We know there's a link.
They say code war.
We say code pink.
It's blood for oil. We know there's a link. They say code war.
We say code pink.
Code pink for freedom. Code pink.
Hello, everybody. This is Rosa Soft coming to you live from New York City, WPFW 89.3 Washington, D.C., and WBAI 99.5 New York City. And this is Code Pink Radio. We're getting a little bit of a late start today, and I apologize for that. It is true that I do have two left feet, and I did have somewhat of a fall on my way over here. But rest assured, I am A-OK, and we have a great show here for you today. So thank you, everybody, for tuning in. For those of you who are not familiar with us, Code Pink is a women's-led anti-war group that is organizing across the country to put an end to U.S.-funded militarism around the world. We are here to challenge imperialism, rogue capitalism, and war, and create a world of justice, peace, and equality. This may sound like a big task, and the truth is that it is. Achieving justice requires each and every one of us to join together in solidarity and demand a better world. And if you're listening to this show, you're already on the right path. Today's show is going to be a bit different. Instead of bringing in outside organizers to talk about their work, we are going to talk a bit about ourselves today. Not because we are vain at Code Pink, although we do look good in pink, but because we want to bring all you listeners into the work we do. Code Pink has been in the anti-war struggle since 2002, and our founders have been in the struggle for far longer than that. So today we are first going to hear from Jody Evans, the co-founder of Code Pink, and she's going to talk about the war and peace economies. And then we are also going to bring in Code Pink organizer Nancy Mencias, an organizer who is working on the anti-war campaign and the divest from war campaign. We are going to be talking specifically about Black Rock with her. But before that, let's get into the news. Let's actually start today with some good news, because there sure is a lot of bad happening in the world. For my New York listeners, I'm sure that you are familiar with the name Daniel Pantaleo. And if you're not familiar with that name, you absolutely should know the name, Erica Garner. In 2014, Eric Garner was murdered by the New York Police Department. He was held in a chokehold while he yelled, "I can't breathe," over and over again. Daniel Pantaleo was his murderer. He held Eric Garner in that illegal chokehold, which ultimately led to Eric's death. And just this week, Daniel Pantaleo has finally, after 5 years, been fired by the NYPD. Now, let's be sure, this is a small victory. There are still many more people on the NYPD who have to be fired, given the NYPD's track record. And ultimately, as an abolitionist, we are working toward a world with no police. But we still can celebrate that today, there is one less murderer on that force. And while there is much work to be done, this is a win we should absolutely celebrate. Now let's turn to Brazil, where matters are not looking that great. Fires have been ravaging Brazil's Amazon rainforest at what scientists are calling an alarming rate. There have been 80% more fires this year than there were last year. And make no mistake, that is because Brazilian President Jair Bolsonaro took control this year and has been implementing violent anti-environment and anti-indigenous policies that have allowed a mass uptick in deforestation of the Amazon rainforest. There are over 1 million indigenous people living in the rainforest, and now they are being driven from their homes. Bolsonaro has used violent rhetoric against Brazil's indigenous people, which many indigenous activists are saying has led to the massive uptick in deforestation of the Amazon rainforest. Much of the recent deforestation is being driven by actually cattle ranchers who are illegally burning huge tracts of land in the rainforest for pasture. And it is noted by activists on the ground that many of these cattle ranchers are far-right Bolsonaro supporters who are also using the deforestation of the rainforest as a tool to terrorize indigenous communities. Turning to the U.S., news and immigration continues to look bleak. This week, Donald Trump has announced that he is seriously considering ending birthright citizenship, which is actually in direct violation of the 14th Amendment. While if he tries to do this, it will likely be brought down in the courts, it is still a concern for many immigrants around the country. Not just that, but he also announced that he is going to be replacing something called the Flores Settlement, which prohibits children from being detained in immigration centers for over 20 days. His new policy is to detain immigrant children with their families indefinitely. And by the way, there's a word for that. It's called concentration camps. And we all must be fighting back against these every day. Now let's turn to what's been dominating national headlines for the past week. Rashida Tlaib, Ilhan Omar, Palestine, Donald Trump, and American Jews. Last time I was on, Palestinian Congresswoman Rashida Tlaib and Congresswoman Ilhan Omar had just been denied entry to Israel. Since then, matters have escalated. Rashida Tlaib applied for a humanitarian visa to enter Israel to visit her grandmother. But she was only going to be given the visa to visit her grandmother if she promised not to pursue any political activities against Israel while there. She ultimately decided not to take the visa that Israel had granted her to visit her grandmother. She tweeted, "When I won, it gave the Palestinian people hope that someone will finally speak truth about the inhumane conditions. I can't allow the state of Israel to take away that light by humiliating me and use my love for my city or grandmother to bow down to their oppressive and racist policies. Silencing me and treating me like a criminal is not what she wants for me. It would kill a piece of me. I have decided that visiting my grandmother under these oppressive conditions stands against everything I believe in, fighting racism, oppression, and injustice." And in a perverse way, Donald Trump is actually helping draw the wedge between Israel and the United States by making the parallels between his government and the Netanyahu government ever so clear. Just this week, he said that American Jews who vote Democrat are, quote, "being very disloyal to the Jewish people, aka themselves, and very disloyal to Israel." Not only is this blatant anti-Semitism, invoking the dual loyalty Trump that we Jews are less loyal to our country because we are somehow more loyal to Israel, it is also Donald Trump lambasting 80% of American Jews who vote Democrat. Donald Trump later went on to suggest that he is, quote, "the king of the Jews" for all he has done for Israel. As an American Jew, I find all of this very funny. Because the truth is, yes, I am disloyal to Trump's regime. Does that mean I am loyal to Israel? Absolutely not. It is my belief and my job that as an American Jew, I need to be disloyal to ethno-nationalists like Netanyahu and Trump. It is not just my job, but all of our jobs to be disloyal to white supremacy and disloyal to injustice. What Donald Trump does not realize is that American Jews are overwhelmingly a progressive people, and we are not going to stand to his anti-Semitism or his oppression of our neighbors. His bigotry has not only opened my community's eyes to the parallels between his racist regime in the U.S. and Netanyahu's ethno-nationalist regime in Israel, but I think that times are changing. I think that this is a turning point, not only for my own American Jewish community, but a turning point in how the U.S. postures itself towards Israel. And for the sake of our collective humanity and Palestinian communities around the world, I sure hope I'm right. And that is the news for today. And in a moment, we are going to be turning to our first interview of the hour. We are going to be talking to none other than Jody Evans. Jody Evans is the co-founder and director of Code Pink. She has been a visionary and advocate for peace for several decades, and she is primarily focused on sharing a global vision for peace and social justice. And just bear with me for one moment while we get Jody on the line. I believe that right now Jody is in China, so there's a little bit of a time difference, but we'll be getting her on the line in just one moment. And she's going to be talking to us a little bit about the history of Code Pink and why Code Pink has decided to take on this important work. So I believe that we now have Jody on the line. Jody, you are now on air with WBAI WPFW. Jody, are you there?
Good morning.
Hello? Oh, technical difficulties. I now hear you. How are you doing today, Jody?
Well, and you?
Doing very well. Well, thank you so much for joining us. So before we kind of get into the heart of our conversation today, can you just give our listeners a bit of history about Code Pink and how it came into being?
Sure. Medea Benjamin and I, the other co-founder of Code Pink, heard the news about the Bush administration drumming up a war in Iraq, and we were shocked. So we met in D.C. and gathered with some other women, Starhawk and Caroline Casey, and said, you know, Bush was frightening the American people into war with his color-coded alerts, orange, red, and yellow, so we called Code Pink for peace. Mm-hmm. And worked to stop the Iraq war with a vigil outside the White House for 6 months. But after they succeeded in their lies, we moved to stopping the next war, which has continued to be Iran since then. And in between the U.S. partners, the U.S. and their partners like Israel and Saudi Arabia wanting to destroy Iran, we have worked to end war funding in Congress. We've been part of the coalition to close Guantanamo. We've done citizens' arrests of U.S. war criminals. We've exposed drones and the horror they are to innocent people and the soldiers deploying them. We've been part of the BDS movement for the people of Palestine. We've led trips around the world to witness so that we could come back and talk about what the mainstream media is not saying. And they've been to places like Iran, Iraq, Afghanistan, Gaza, Palestine, Cuba, Honduras, Venezuela, I'm trying to think of others. We have one going to Iran in a few weeks. Mm-hmm. And we've stood against wars and answer everywhere. And we've worked in coalitions to close U.S. bases and stop new ones. And the war is not green. We work to end the war economy and cultivate a local peace economy. Mm-hmm. We've worked globally and locally, and we engage weekly in Washington, D.C. and New York City.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think that anybody who has met you, Jody, can attest to the fact that you talk a lot about something called the war economy and the peace economy. And I think that these are just such important ideas that really do guide the work that Code Pink does. So I'm wondering if you could just take a moment to tell our listeners what it means to be in a war economy and what it means to be in a peace economy.
So, yeah, it was after many years of trying to end war that all of a sudden it dawned on me that, oh, you know, it's the war economy. War is just serving the war economy. And we were not going to be able to stop war until we could stop the war economy. And the war economy is not, you know, that's genocide, climate change, poverty, mass incarcerations, all the political, social, ecological crises are essentially out of a war economy. I call it the extractive, destructive, oppressive economy. And, you know, war economy, short for imperialist, white, supremacist, capitalist, hetero, patriarchy. So it's easier to say war economy. So it is the system, the culture that we live in, and it continues to grow in its ferocity and violence. I say it's killing us, our communities, and the entire planet. But we, you know, even those of us at Code Pink who are working to end war, we are engaged in the war economy. And so it really became, it's recognizing that we are, and what does that look like and how does it affect us? One of the things that we really see clearly at Code Pink is how the war economy, you know, works to make us all transactional instead of relational, and how that has just become a way of our culture and our way of our being and what we think is normal and natural. And so we work to break those habits. Mm-hmm. The war economy, you know, runs you by time, and it creates a sense of scarcity and a sense of alienation.
Absolutely.
So how do we kind of break those patterns? And then you look, and then I was kind of looking, going, okay, well, if there's a war economy, what would the peace economy look like? And the peace economy exists. Not only does it exist, it's the reason we are all alive. It's the giving, sharing, caring, thriving, relational economy. It is what creates the conditions conducive for life. But if you look at the war economy, every year it squeezes more, privatizes, it devalues what all those things are. And we operate kind of like it's the war economy that is going to save us and give us life because our jobs come out of it. But our jobs come out of like being sucked, you know, into money, into the pockets of the wealthy. And so it's how do we recognize where we are and how do we change? And one of the places I suggest we practice is locally. So economy, it sounds complicated, but it's really basically a system of relationships. And in Greek, it means to create home. So if we start to practice what it is to create conditions conducive for life and a home that we want to live in, we actually have a better grounding to talk about the bigger issues. And we will practice what it is to be in relationship, what it is to be in community, what it is to listen, what it is to be committed, you know, what it is to truly be a revolutionary.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think a really important point about the war and peace economy is that it's not only structural, like you said, it's also local and it's personal. And I'm wondering if you can just give our listeners a few ways that they can engage in the peace economy, a few ways that we can change our lives every day to make that personal transition from thinking about our existence in the war economy to trying to create a peace economy and trying to create the world in which we want to live.
Well, the peace economy actually exists. We don't have to create it. We just need to keep cultivating it and enriching it. People who don't live as privileged as we do in the United States know what a peace economy is because it's basically their culture. Coming from Iran a couple of months ago, I was really reminded of this because it's not such a capitalistic culture. It's a more local culture. And it's also it's the culture itself is one of giving and sharing. So it's a whole culture is how do we take care of each other because we thrive when we're related, when we're caring for each other, including the stranger. So we, you know, U.S. citizens walking around Iran are embraced because we all are also human, which reminded me of when we first went to Iraq, when we were about to bomb Iraq.
Absolutely.
And we were surprised at how kind and generous they were to us. like, we're Americans. We're coming from the country that's about to, you know, create shock and awe. And the clarity of, you know, living inside a peace economy is that you know that people are people and power is power. And they would say, we're not Saddam and you're not Bush. And that we first relate to each other as human beings. So the start is that to come out of the individuality, the individualist culture that we live in, is to create a circle of friends, to come together with your neighbors, with friends, pull together a group that you have a commitment to. You say, we're going to get together once a month. And we have practices on the Code Pink website, but really it's to sit together for an hour and a half and have that commitment to see who's in the room, what needs to be seen. There are those of us sitting in the room, but there are others who are really at the effects of the war economy in our country. And who are they in our community? An example from my community, Venice, California, we did some research and found out that 1,500 homeless youth were living in the community ages 15 to 25. So then we have to figure out, like, so what do we do? Well, we love them. What does that look like? Well, let's start with feeding them out of the back of our cars on Saturday and get to know them and have them trust us and learn from them and see what they need next. Oh, they needed a place where they could have a hot meal a couple times a week. They needed backpacks. They needed condoms so the girls didn't get pregnant. They needed, you know, all kinds of things. So we got the Baptist church around the corner from me to give Thursday nights, to give the space. And then they could come and they could feel what it is to be respected and loved and their needs served. And so then we could see they really needed counseling. So we put out for volunteer counselors. Mm-hmm. And that so, has grown into being a model for supporting and loving in a city where there's a lot of violence against homelessness. It's been the model of, no, there's another way to do this.
Mm-hmm. It's about working together, caring for each other, and most importantly, listening to the people who do have needs and finding out what we can do to help them rather than assuming what they need.
And are paying the biggest price of the war economy. Mm-hmm. Personal and daily. I mean, I think the reason the war economy gets to prosper is there's too many people engaging in it and consciously that aren't at the effects of it.
Yeah.
If they were at the effects of it, like those in the streets, their behaviors would change, but they get away with their behavior, and that is really destructive across the world.
And that actually just leads me right into my next question. So, like you said, there are people who are actively maintaining and perpetuating this war economy, and, you know, more often than not, in fact, probably never, are these people actually bearing the brunt of what it means to exist in a war economy. And from there comes in one of Code Pink's new and biggest campaigns, the Divest from the War Machine campaign. So I'm wondering if you can just tell us briefly about what this campaign means, what it means to divest from the war machine, and how this helps move us away from a war economy.
Thank you. Good question. Yes, in looking at the war economy, it's like, how do you make these things become real and tangible so that everybody can interact with them and look at them and see how it affects their lives? Well, so if you talk about, you know, building a peace economy locally, you find out that your city, your state, your county, your church, your university or college, or your pension plan are all invested in war. They're, what I say, invested in making a killing on killing. And the weapons companies are very clever. You know, they make sure that a piece of whatever weapon they're building is happening in every congressional district so they can hang it over the Congress members' vote that if you don't vote for this, people in your district are going to lose jobs. And then they get everyone to invest and get a return on investment so that their weapons, it's $1.5 trillion a year, are the sale of weapons.
Wow.
I was part of a film called The Shadow World, where basically the weapons trader says, I don't understand. Why don't they just give us the money? It would make the world safer. Because this isn't about war. This is just about greed. Mm-hmm. So we're watching that greed. And if you look at, so 65% of your tax dollars goes to war. Half of that goes to weapons manufacturing. And in the last 5 years, 40% of that went straight to the pockets of the rich.
Wow.
So we basically have war for profit. And as we know, when things are for profit, why would they end, right? People are filling their pockets with extra money. So when you bring it down to your city, for many years, we had campaigns whenever the mayors would meet, asking the mayors to sign a resolution saying to Congress, don't vote money for more war, vote money for our communities. Money from war needs to serve our communities. We got 100% of the mayors on our side. Well, that's because it's just a resolution. It doesn't have teeth. So being able to bring this back to the cities and say, you voted this way, now we need your commitment and your behavior to say, no, I'm going to take all the weapons companies out of the investments we have in the city. Or, you know, we have the governor from the state of Oregon who said, yes, I am going to make sure that we're not investing in weapons for the state of Oregon. We have campaigns at CalSTRS and CalPERS, the largest retirement funds in the country, working through to get us them to divest from the war machine. There are funds that are, you know, for religious organizations and getting them to divest. I would say what happens is like what happened when it's like there's a war economy, peace economy. People just don't know. And once mm-hmm. you make them aware, then you bring the cost of war and war home to them. So, again, we can build the movement we need to not only divest from the war machine, but end wars.
Jody, are you there?
Yes.
I'm sorry, I think you cut out for a moment. Can you just repeat the last thing you said?
Not just divesting from the war machine, but to end wars.
To end wars, absolutely. And I think that this is a really exciting campaign that we're getting off the ground all throughout the United States. And I have a few more questions about that, but I want to turn it to the audience for a moment and see if we have any listener callers. So if you're in New York City or Washington, D.C., you can go ahead and dial 212-209-2877. And we'll give you a minute to call in and ask any questions that you might have of Jody about the war and peace economy, what it means to divest, how we can divest, etc.
We also have something called the weaponsfreefund.org, and that's a place where you can learn a lot about what's in weapons, what's invested in weapons, and what isn't. So it's a tool that can be used by city, states, counties, your university, and just, you know, remembering that it's also a tool to have this conversation, to make people wake up to how much the war is being invested by them. And so they can look at the people at the border, they can look at what's happening in Iraq or Iran and, you know, be heartbroken. But we're also making that happen with our habits every day.
Absolutely.
And if we're going to end this, we have to change our behavior and we have to change our culture.
That we do. And we do have a listener caller on the line, WBAIWPFW. You're on the air.
Oh, hi. Yeah, thank you. First of all, I applaud the good work you're doing with the homeless and the private charity. That's really good. I would like your view, though, on what do you see any value in capitalism at all, or should we try to move more to a collectivist, community-owned economy? And I'd like to have another question if I can have the answer to that.
So I hope that, you know, we move away from this war economy that, you know, is, like I said, it's a shorthand for imperialist, white supremacist, capitalist, hetero patriarchy. So in the moving away, the solutions have to arise. I'm not going to say where we should go. It's that we can't even, our imagination is taken away by the war economy. We don't even, it literally steals our imagining. And there are so many ways we can imagine to make this work. So we're not saying where it should go, except more cultivation of peace economies, which are the collective community relationship committed just economies.
Well, okay, no, that's helpful. But I think if you look at the economic history over the last two, you'll find that there's been no economic system, no demand that has brought more people out of poverty and has helped poor people more than capitalism. And I think the real risk of collectivism
is what we've seen.
Let me finish, please. We've seen tens and tens of millions of people get killed in Russia or the Soviet Union and China. We've seen that collectivism. Now, private charity is wonderful. What you're doing with the homeless is fantastic. But, you know, it's simply labeling the economic system that has brought more people out of poverty than any other system known to man as a war economy. I think it's dishonest. I think it's divisive. And I think it's really destructive. I mean, you know, every time collectivism has been tried, it's failed miserably and resulted in the deaths of tens of hundreds of millions of people. The place you're at right now, and I also would like to know, how much funding do you get from foreign governments? Thank you.
Sure. Well, I have to disagree with you, but I think the war economy has been more violent than a collectivist economy. And so we'll just have to disagree there. And no, we don't. We only get funding from individuals and very little amount of funding at that.
Thank you so much for that question. And Jody, thank you for your excellent answers and for all of the knowledge that you've brought to our listeners today. We're going to go to a brief music break. And then we're going to be joined by Nancy Mencias for a conversation about divestment on the ground, what that looks like. Again, this is Rose with WBAI 99.5, WPFW
get offline, plug into this modem. No, you can't outvote them. The rules are still golden. Only jewels we holding, if we guard our scrotum. If you press the ear to the turf that is stolen, you can hear the sound of limitations exploding. Please, sir, may we have another portion with children of the beast that dodge the abortion. Neck placed firm between the floor and the portion. We'll shut your shit down, don't call it extortion. Caution, we're coming for your head. So call the feds and get files and shred. Every textbook read said bring you the bread. But guess what, we got you instead.
We got the guillotine. We got the guillotine. You better run. We got the guillotine. We got the guillotine. You better run. We got the guillotine. We got the guillotine. You better run. We got the guillotine. We got the guillotine.
Everybody, we are back here with WBAI 99.5, WPFW 89.3. We're actually having some difficulties getting our next guest on the line, so we might be bringing back Jody Evans for another conversation. Jody is an infinite wealth of knowledge, so if we're joined by her for another 10 to 15 minutes, I promise you that you won't be missing out. But with Nancy and perhaps with Jody, what we wanted to talk about is what the Divest from War campaign actually looks like on the ground and what activists are doing around the country to help us divest from war. You know, when I was in college, I actually spearheaded a divestment resolution in the NYU student government, and we were calling for our university to divest from the war machine that it was actively invested in. You know, you have these institutions that are supposedly liberal institutions like NYU, but then you dig a little deeper, you look into their investments, and you realize that they have money stowed away in Lockheed Martin, General Electric, Raytheon, etc. And if you're not familiar with these companies, you should be, because these are the corporations that are building bombs, that are building fighter jets, and these weapons are being used to kill people all over the world. It was recently the anniversary, actually, of the school bus bombing in Yemen, when Saudi airstrikes killed 44 Yemeni children on their way to school and injured many more. And where did Saudi Arabia get that bomb? Where did Saudi Arabia get that weapon to inflict such suffering on these Yemeni children just going to school? Well, it got it from U.S. weapons manufacturers. None other than a bomb made by Lockheed Martin with collaboration from General Electric. And, you know, reasons like that are why we are calling on our institutions to divest from war. Lockheed Martin is also the manufacturer of something called the F-16 Fighting Falcon jets. And these jets are actually regularly used by the Israeli government to target civilian populations in Gaza and destroy civilian infrastructure. And my university, NYU, has investments in them. And, you know, not just NYU, but so many universities, our pension funds, our banks are invested in these corporations that are profiting on killing. Like Jody said, they're making a killing on killing. And we have to recognize our own individual complicity. We have to realize that so long as we are a part of these institutions, like Jody said, so long as we participate in the war economy, which, you know, in the United States in 2019, you really can't, we are actively engaged with these crimes. We are complicit in our own way. And not only to absolve ourselves of our complicity, but also to help bring about global justice, it's our responsibility to hold our institutions' feet to the fire. And, you know, a lot of times these divestment resolutions that will pop up at college campuses get a lot of opposition. We did ours at NYU in the spirit of the boycott, divestment and sanctions movement. And, you know, I also mention I am Israeli. I am a Jewish Israeli. I come from a Jewish Israeli household. And, you know, people will throw these allegations of, oh, you hate the state of Israel. Oh, you hate the Jewish people. But as a Jewish Israeli, you know, obviously that is not the case. We have to work to separate the religions and identities that these ethno-nationalist regimes will try to co-opt. And then we also have to be very aware of the violence that these regimes are enacting on the minority, or in some cases, the majority population. You know, when we look to Israel, we look to the Palestinian population in Gaza, in the West Bank, and living in Israel, along with the Palestinian refugee population all over the world. And we recognize that the Jewish majority in Israel in many ways has been manufactured through somewhat of a program of ethnic cleansing. So we have to realize that, you know, when we call for BDS, when we are in solidarity with Palestinians through these divestment measures, it really has nothing to do with the Jewish people. It has nothing to do with an aversion to the Israeli people. I'm Jewish and Israeli. It has to do with working in solidarity with people who, like Jody said, are bearing the brunt of the war economy. And now to talk a little bit more about this, we have Nancy Mencias on the line. Nancy is a campaign organizer with Code Pink, an anti-war advocate, and a part of the movement against torture. She is heading up a big part of Code Pink's Divest from the War Machine campaign, which we're going to talk a little bit about today. Nancy, are you there?
Yes, I'm here, Rose.
Hi, Nancy.
Great to hear you.
Thank you so much for joining us today. So,
thank you.
Before we get into the specifics of the campaign, can you just tell us a little bit about the work you've been doing?
Sure. Why don't I just give you a little background on the BlackRock campaign? We have a campaign to compel BlackRock to divest from weapon manufacturers. They are headquartered in New York. They're the world's largest asset manager, managing people's assets, dealing with the company or organization's investments. They manage about $6.5 trillion of assets. They're referred to as the largest shadow bank. And for Code Pink, we, for over a year and a half, we have had this campaign focusing on Larry Fink. He's the founder of BlackRock since 1988. He founded the Institute along with seven of other of his partners. He graduated from UCLA, and he is on the board of directors at MoMA and the Nature Conservancy, and he resides somewhere in the New York area, and his billions in personal wealth. And a couple of years ago, he penned a letter to stakeholders asking them to be socially responsible corporate citizens. He talked about how those with capital reap the benefits after the big financial crisis. You remember in 2008, there was a huge protest movement right there on Wall Street. So he says, in order to sustain performance, you must understand the societal impact of your business, from wage growth, automation, to climate change. And, you know, this all sounds good on paper, but the CEO's words ring hollow and insincere. And Larry Fink, he, just like all the other Wall Street tycoons, is someone who operates with no moral compass. So I can talk a little bit about that when we delve into their investments. quickly.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I was wondering if you can kind of paint a picture for us of what their investments look like, because we know that BlackRock, as I like to say, is intersectional in its oppressive investments. Not only is it invested in the war machine, but it's also invested in corporations that are scorching the earth and private prisons. So I'm wondering if you can just paint a picture for us about how BlackRock invests and how those investments manifest in our world.
Sure. So BlackRock is the largest investor in the top five weapon manufacturers. So it may have been noted earlier in your program that the top five are Boeing, Raytheon, Lockheed Martin, Northrop Grumman, and General Dynamics. And what BlackRock has, they have a grocery bag of weapons in their iShares U.S. Aerospace and Defense ETF. And it's net at about $5 billion. And we'd like to see BlackRock close this ETF. Now, they will argue that this ETF is performing well, so they're not going to close it. And they will also argue that they're the middleman. So why come after us when you should be going after investors? Well, we are going after investors. But when they argue that they're the middleman, we can look and see who else is a middleman. We can say the local bodega is a middleman. Your local grocery store is a middleman. And they put the grocery items on their shelf. And if those items on the shelf make your local community sick, cause any physical harm, then what happens? You recall those items, you take them off the shelf. So this is what we want BlackRock to do, is we want them to take this grocery bag full of weapons that are harming people internationally off their shelf and not make it available for investors to purchase.
Absolutely. And can you just tell us a little bit about the work that we have done around BlackRock? Because, you know, like you said, BlackRock has a very sizable grocery bag of all sorts of awful investments sitting on its shelf, and knocking those down is a difficult task. But we at Code Pink, joined by a coalition of other groups, have been working to chip away at that shelf, to make that shelf fall. So can you just tell us a little bit about what we've been doing to kind of mess with their structure and help bring about this fall and this change?
Sure. So as I mentioned, the campaign has been running for about a year and a half. And in that time, we've bottom line a couple of demonstrations at their annual shareholders meeting in New York. We've also had a peaceful presence outside their offices in London, New York, L.A., Dallas, Santa Monica, San Francisco, and Athens, Greece. Larry Fink, the CEO, has an institute on the campus of UCLA, so we've had a presence at their UCLA campus. As you mentioned, we have built alliances with other organizations. When we started out, we were sort of the, we went at it on our own. And so we build alliances. We work with local organizations like Veterans for Peace, the Granny Peace Brigade. We've also nurtured organizations and movements along, like the climate change movements. We've pressured BlackRock stakeholders, such as the International Rescue Committee. We pressured them not to give the CEO a humanitarian award. So our friends and allies, they vary. We have ACT UP New York, who has been focusing on Gilead pharmacies. They're asking BlackRock to sell the Gilead stock, because Gilead has raised the price of its drugs on HIV treatment and prevention. Also, the BlackRock Big Problem, they are a coalition of climate change activists. And also, there have been some significant movements in their part. There was a 92-page report released from the Institute for Energy Economics and Financial Analysis indicating that they had lost that BlackRock had lost investors more than $90 billion in value destruction and opportunity. The loss were from its investments in the oil companies. So they're big investors in Exxon, Chevron, Royal Dutch Shell, and BP. And this report is accessible. You just got to Google it online. And then there's Worth Rises, which has been focusing on using those who invest in the private prison industrial complex, like Geo Group and Core Civics, BlackRock, along with Vanguard, are large investors in the private prison movement. But recently, Vanguard has divested from the Geo Group, and they say that they want to invest in companies with strong environmental, societal, mm-hmm. and governance records. So if Vanguard, BlackRock's competitor, investment competitor, can divest from private prisons, then BlackRock can also divest from private prisons.
Absolutely.
And they can also divest from weapon manufacturers. Mm-hmm. So,
and it's kind of creating this chain effect, this domino effect, by once you knock down one, the precedent is kind of set for all of these other institutions to begin the process of divestment.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So maybe this is a good time to talk about next steps. What do you think?
Absolutely, yes. So I was actually going to plug our most recent campaign that we are going to be launching en masse in October. I'm sure that the listeners have heard of the Museum of Modern Art. And like Nancy mentioned, Larry Fink, the CEO of BlackRock, sits on the board of the Museum of Modern Art. And we are going to actually build on the work of Decolonize This Place, which is a New York-based action-oriented movement, which is centered around the indigenous struggle, Black liberation, a free Palestine, global wage workers, and gentrification. We're going to target the Whitney. We're going to target the MoMA, in the same way they targeted the Whitney Museum of American Art, by getting somebody off the board named Warren Kanders, who is the CEO of Safariland, which is a company that actually made the tear gas that is used against immigrants at the southern border, against protesters in Palestine, and against people in Puerto Rico. So we are going to build on that momentum created by the Kanders campaign, and we are going to be launching a campaign against MoMA. And Nancy, if you can just tell our listeners a bit about how they can get involved, that would be great. We have just a few minutes, so if you could just kind of make it fast, and then we'll wrap up.
Sure. So for listeners, you can go to codepink.org/BlackRock to sign a petition. If you check back at our website, we will have more information about the MoMA campaign, which Rose just mentioned. And you can join us next year outside the shareholders meeting when we have a protest in the month of May 2020. So those are a few ways to get involved.
Amazing. Well, thank you so much, Nancy. I don't think we have time for listener questions today, but thank you so much for joining us, and I hope that you all heed Nancy's advice.
Thank you.
And that has been Code Pink Radio for today. Just some other quick ways you can get involved is by going to codepink.org. If you are New York City based, you can shoot me an email at rose@codepink.org, and I'll plug you into all of the events upcoming around the city. Follow us on Twitter at Code Pink. Follow us on Facebook at Code Pink as well. Don't forget to call your congressperson and tell them to stop taking campaign contributions from weapon manufacturers and the NRA. This is Rose Assoff. This has been Code Pink Radio, WBAI 99.5, WPFW 89.3. Thank you for listening, and peace.
We trained him to be our man when our enemy was not Iraq but Iran.
They feed you lies, don't want you to think.
They say code terror,
we say code pink.
They feed you lies, don't want you to think. They say code terror,
we say code pink.
Code pink for freedom, code pink for peace, code pink till hunger and war have ceased. Code pink for women. Together we'll make peace.
Yo, this is G Love on WBAI, New York, New York.
WBAI, New York.